Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
For a bit of seasonal giving, we're discounting our print-only subscription package. You can get our beautiful magazine delivered to your doorstep every week for a year for just £149 in the UK and $149 in the US. Our print-only sale is also available for gift subscriptions, so it's a saving of over £100 or $100 on the normal price. Go to newscientist.com/printsale to get this offer.
Yeah, and I also wanted to tell you about the special holiday Christmas and New Year double issue of New Scientist magazine. It's hitting shops on the 15th of December. It's a real treat. There's a search for a mysterious long-lost land. There's vegan fine dining, the world's laziest animals, there's fiendish quizzes, an exclusive short story, our review of all the biggest science stories of the year. It's absolutely a real treat. Get it in shops from the 15th of December, or you can enjoy audio or digital versions of this issue in our app.
Hello and welcome to New Scientist Weekly. As you know, this is the show that brings you a curated selection of the essential stories of the week. Our aim is to feed your curiosity. I'm your host, Rowan Hooper.
And I'm Penny Sarchet. Welcome to the show. This week, we're joined by New Scientist journalists James Deneen and Madeline Cuff, both in Montreal, and Matt Sparks in London. Welcome all.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
We've got a fantastic show this week. We'll be hearing from James and Maddie about the latest from the COP15 Biodiversity Summit. That's later in the show. And we've got an interview with the acclaimed sci-fi writer Adrian Tchaikovsky.
We've also got a story on how to detect the warp drive signature of alien spacecraft, which I personally, is something I always need to do. and I've been finding out how there's a surprising amount of references to climate change in Shakespeare, and how the energy transition from wood to coal as a fuel source is actually described in Shakespeare.
Amazing stuff. You going to read some Shakespeare for us?
I am. I'm playing Queen Titania, because in A Midsummer Night's Dream, she talks about climate change.
Ah, I don't remember that bit.
No,
I can't wait to hear it. but we start with what hopefully could be another energy transition. This is the absolutely huge news this week of a breakthrough in nuclear fusion. Matt, you've been reporting all about this for us. What is the breakthrough that we had this week?
So for the first time on Earth, we've had a controlled fusion reaction that's generated more power than it requires to run. That's pretty exciting, because it's perhaps the biggest sign we've had so far that fusion power is really viable.
Matt, were you have you been waiting your whole career to write "for the first time on Earth" in a story?
Yeah, I have, and I finally got to do it.
Excellent. You can retire. No, tell us first what. Tell us more about it. How has it finally happened?
So there's two main approaches to working on fusion at the moment. One uses magnetic fields to contain plasma, and the other one uses lasers. And this last week, we've heard that one of these laser experiments at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory in California, it's crossed that milestone that no fusion reactor of any design has ever managed, which is to break even.
So to break even in terms of the power in and power out that it generates. What's the buzz been like amongst people you've spoken to? Is this the real deal?
So the scientists I've spoken to, they say it's pretty big. One even mentioned the word Nobel, but he didn't want me to quote him on that by name. But there's also this sort of pragmatic caution, because we're definitely not ready to start building reactors.
Yeah, so there's various reasons, I guess, that this isn't actually a useful and reliable generator of power yet. So what needs to be done for us to get to that dream?
So a lot, in short. So the break-even point comes with some caveats. This reactor, it works by squeezing a tiny amount of fuel with almost 200 lasers to kickstart this fusion reaction. Previously, these lasers, they've required more energy than the reaction actually puts out. So what happened last week is simply that the energy output of the reaction exceeded the energy output of those lasers. It's not a small thing, because these lasers, they're the world's most powerful lasers. They've got a peak power of 500 trillion watts. So when they fire, for a very brief period, they draw more power than the entire US national grid puts out.
Wow.
But it's not really telling the whole story, because the lasers, they're pretty inefficient. So to output the 2 megajoules, the lasers drew roughly 300 megajoules from the electrical grid. So we got a little bit more than 3 megajoules of energy out, and we had to put in either 2 or 300 megajoules, depending on how you look at it.
Right. So we need to get it to put out more than the 300 megajoules that are needed to power these lasers before this would actually kind of work as something that actually net produces energy rather than uses it.
Exactly. Yeah. So we need to get the energy requirements of those lasers down, which scientists say should be possible because they date back to, you know, the 1980s and 1990s, or ideally both, you know, and that's just a break even as well. You wouldn't make a lot of money running a power plant that runs just above break even point. But there's other problems as well. The reactor runs for a few billionths of a second, and then it takes hours to cool down before it can run again. So, you know, a working reactor needs to run constantly. And then there's the problem with fuel. Currently, it's really difficult to create these tiny capsules of fuel. You know, tiny imperfections in these round capsules, even something the size of a bacteria, can upset the reaction, and they need to be perfectly smooth. So we also need a cheap way of manufacturing that.
I mean, are all these considered, you know, just small problems now on the way to commercial nuclear fusion? Now we've passed this barrier. Has the big barrier been cleared?
I think what it does is it sort of proves that fusion is viable. So it's a sort of a motivational milestone to have passed. And there's certainly some low-hanging fruit to be had. So the facility we're talking about, it was designed with experiments and sort of adaptability in mind, not necessarily generating power. So there's definitely improvements that could be made there. You know, this is 20, 30, 40-year-old technology. But all these remaining engineering problems, they're pretty big. We're still a long way off plugging a fusion reactor into the grid.
There's been quite a few announcements, haven't there, of various kind of maybe slightly smaller breakthroughs, but still technical breakthroughs in the quest for fusion this year. And some of them have been coming from other types of trying to do this, using things like magnets instead of lasers to kind of control plasma and all the rest of it. Do we know what's going to win out at the end? Are you backing a horse at this point, Matt?
So I think magnets are attracting most of the money and most of the attention at the moment, but it is this laser experiment that just hit break-even point for the first time. So it's not a neglected area. But there is a feeling amongst the people I've spoken to that magnets are the most likely design to win out in the end. But we're seeing a lot of commercial startups doing a lot of sort of interesting designs. And one scientist told me that diversity like that is probably key to getting fusion online quickly. You know, to try a lot of things very quickly and move on if they don't work.
I think we're obliged to say that, you know, it is very exciting. You know, we've crossed this big threshold, but there's, as you say, there's a long way to go. So it's not going to be basically until the end of the century, really, is it? The second half of the century that we really get this up and going. And in other words, for people looking for a solution to climate change, we still need to go to the fusion reactor in the sky and renewable energy to get us out of that.
Yeah, I think so. You know, predictions on how far away fusion is have been notoriously unreliable, but anywhere, I'm hearing this week, anywhere from 15 years to another 30 to another 60. We can't sit back and sort of wait for this to solve climate change. We certainly need to keep going on renewables.
All right, let's go to Montreal now for the latest on the biodiversity meeting. This is COP15. Maddie, you've only just got back from COP27. Now you've got a bit of whiplash and you're in Montreal at COP15. What's it like there? Tell us what's at stake, because ideally we want a biodiversity treaty like we had with the Paris Accord, with the climate treaty. But what would that look like for biodiversity?
Yeah, so that's right. So the biodiversity COPs work in a slightly different way to the climate COPs, but they also have lots of similarities. And the reason why this COP, COP15, is a really big deal is because it is a once in a decade opportunity to set some global goals for nature. So to kind of set a really long-term direction for the global community, which will aim to put nature on the path to being restored by 2030 and for the world to be, this is rather ambitious, but to be living in harmony with nature by 2050. And this is really crucial, not just because obviously we need a healthy ecosystem to serve, you know, water, to grow food, for kind of everything that kind of creates, keeps human society going, but it is also crucial to the fight against climate change. So you don't really succeed at delivering on the promises of the Paris Agreement without solving this issue of nature. So that's why this COP15 summit that we've just landed at is a really crucial one. The agreement here will be a really good measure of progress to whether we can enact the goals of the Paris Agreement, essentially. So I landed last night. So I'm still sort of trying to get my bearings at this cavernous conference centre in Montreal. And it's a bit of a weird vibe. I was expecting, given the kind of seriousness of what's at stake here and the scale of ambition that countries are talking about, I was expecting a little bit more buzz and a bit more excitement and noise. But it's pretty muted. There's not as many people here. There aren't noisy protests in the corridors. Everything's quite hushed and calm, which when it comes to big global negotiations is not necessarily what you want to see.
And James, you've been covering mining there. Tell us about what's been discussed so far and what's been agreed.
Yeah, mining, maybe a bit of an unexpected subject for a summit on biodiversity, but mining projects are inherently destructive and can have significant impacts on biodiversity as well as local and indigenous communities. So on Monday, the Canadian Minister of Natural Resources announced on the sidelines of COP15 a new alliance between Canada and six other rich countries, including the US, the UK, and Australia, to try to minimize some of those impacts. Critical minerals include minerals like lithium and cobalt and copper, which are all needed for the green energy transition, for things like batteries, for electric vehicles, and renewable energy technology. And demand for all of them is expected to explode in coming years, which means more mining and more processing. Lots of that mining will happen in countries that aren't part of this alliance, especially in China, which dominates critical minerals mining and processing. And it's unclear how countries in the alliance would make sure mining is sustainable outside their borders. But countries in this alliance represent a gigantic market, so a commitment from them to make their critical mineral supply chains more sustainable could have a big influence elsewhere. And something that's interesting, that the sentiment of behind the alliance, at least, is part of this larger discussion at COP15 around an agreement to end subsidies for industries that drive biodiversity loss, like unsustainable logging or unsustainable fisheries, though nothing is agreed around that yet.
So Maddie, you know, it's feeling a little bit negative there at the moment. You know, if this limps over the line, you know, I've heard people saying we could get a Copenhagen situation, you know, in other words, a really weak treaty like we got at Copenhagen in 2006 or 8, whenever it was. You know, if we do that, what does that mean for biodiversity and planetary life support? You know, these are only every 10 years, aren't they?
So the Copenhagen moment analogy is interesting, because I don't think it will be the same thing as Copenhagen, where, I mean, essentially the talks fell apart, right? And what they managed to scrabble together at the end was a really weak kind of backup plan that was not what the summit aimed to do in the first place, to kind of create that global treaty. I think what will happen this time around is that they will come out with something and they will agree these goals. I don't, after 2 years of delay because of COVID, I think everybody here is very keen that we leave with these new set of targets and with a direction of travel for the post-2020 framework. The danger, though, is that it's a bit of a fudge and it's not as ambitious as it could have been. And because all of these agreements are non-binding, the way these things are drafted and worded is really important, because it is then about how it's implemented on the ground. And if countries sign up to something that gives them quite a lot of wiggle room to essentially go back home and carry on business as usual, then we won't see anything like the scale of change that is needed on the ground. So the really key issues, like the financing framework, will determine whether or not what is actually agreed here kind of happens in the real world next year. So I think that is the kind of main risk, that it ends up, everybody comes out with something, it looks great on paper, but actually it's not strong enough and not detailed enough that it has any kind of real world impact.
Right. Well, we'll just have to wait and see. Thank you, Maddie and James, for joining us from Montreal. Let's take a quick break. Are you looking for a unique gift this holiday? What about a gift that helps fight global warming? With Climeworks, you can now remove excess carbon dioxide from the air in the names of your friends and family. So Climeworks is the leader in direct air capture. That's a technology that removes carbon dioxide from the air. Once captured, it's stored underground using the CarbFix method. And this is an accelerated natural process that turns carbon dioxide into stone, where it no longer contributes to global warming. So this holiday, choose the gift of climate impact at climeworks.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
That's the Sci-Fi Alert, which means we're reporting on something in the news that has already been explored in science fiction. And this week, Rowan, it's warp drives.
Yes, we've invented the warp drive. No, I think that would be the top of the show. What we found, though, is a way to spot the stretching in the fabric of space-time that would occur if a warp drive is activated.
So, yeah, okay, that's kind of amazing. But also, Why are we talking about spotting something that we've no idea if it exists beyond Star Trek?
Yes, good question. So this is about gravitational waves. And those, as you'll remember, are the ripples in space-time that are formed when, you know, you get these massive objects colliding or moving around. And they were first detected in 2015 by LIGO. That's the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory. And that observed the ripples in space-time as like two black holes collided and merged together. So the idea then is you could use LIGO to look for gravitational waves made by an alien spacecraft if it was big enough and moving fast enough to make these ripples in space-time.
Right. So how big are we talking here? Because we're talking about LIGO and gravitational waves. Black holes are massive.
Yeah. So they found that the spacecraft would need to be the mass of Jupiter, which is pretty big, and traveling at a tenth of the speed of light. So 30,000 kilometers per second.
Okay. So huge and very, very fast.
I guess these advanced aliens need a lot of room for their civilizations. Yeah, I mean, it either has to have this huge mass, or if it has a warp drive, then it could literally warp space-time, and then you could detect it using this new theory. And the researchers behind this piece of work have found that LIGO could spot a craft, this kind of, you know, alien craft, if it travelled, you know, within 326,000 light years of Earth. And they say that even more sensitive gravitational wave detectors could bring that distance closer. So this is going to be really interesting to SETI people, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence.
So I'm playing along with this then.
Yes, thank you.
If you did detect something, how could you tell if it was a comet or a meteor just, you know, doing its thing in space, or a spacecraft? Because if it's 300,000 light years away, how do we know?
Yeah, well, our reporter Lea Crane actually asked them this, and they said that you could tell the difference between, say, a meteor and a warp drive because it's the same way you can tell whether a jet ski has gone past you or a boat, because the waves they make have a different signature. And a warp drive also would have a unique kind of way of affecting the gravitational field around them.
Cool. So I'm guessing you're not going to go for something as obvious as Star Trek as the sci-fi link here.
No, I'm not actually. I went for the planet-sized spacecraft rather than warp drive, and it turns out there are some. There's one in Robert Reed's Great Ship series, which is aptly named, and there's one that specifically said a spacecraft to be bigger than Jupiter.
Oh, perfect.
Now, we've spoken quite a bit on the podcast about the energy crisis, and of course that was sparked by Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the subsequent squeeze on gas supplies to Europe. But I wanted to add some historical context to this, because I was reading about an earlier energy crisis in the 16th century in England, and this was one triggered by basically mass deforestation, and that led to the first use of coal as a fuel source. So to talk about this, I'm joined by Randall Martin of the University of New Brunswick in Canada. Randall, thank you for joining us. Now, you're a Shakespearean scholar, and I was reading your book, Shakespeare in Ecology, and I was amazed by the amount of ecological references in Shakespeare. So can you set the scene for us?
Yes, there was a comparable, of course, smaller scale than today, and different caused energy crisis in the 16th and 17th centuries. But Shakespeare was an observer of this. I think of Shakespeare as having a triple eye for these things. He was a playwright, a professional playwright, interested in creating dramatic, exciting plays that made money. He was also a poet, a superb poet, and he had an eye for the natural world and for changes in the world that were exceptional. And the third thing is that he had an ecologist's eye. He observed there was new limits to the consumption of resources. He had a very keen eye for the interconnectedness of things, not only in the natural world, but between the human world and the natural world and the animal worlds. So all of these things, you know, we think of ecology as being, you know, everything is connected. Well, Shakespeare had a keen eye for observing that the things were connected and also things were being disrupted and changing.
It sounds familiar.
It sounds very, oh, these things sound very, very familiar, don't they?
Yeah.
They're very
yeah.
familiar to the kind of energy supply and security problems and food security problems that we now are facing in our world. All of those pressures, demographic pressures, climate change pressures, and rising prices meant that some people were getting rich and from the rising prices and making money and building new houses or enlarging their houses or their farms and showing them off and consuming more.
I mean, it's amazing what you find in plays that even the ones that I thought I was familiar with, like there's a bit in A Midsummer Night's Dream when
yes.
Titania says, she's talking about the altered seasons.
Yes.
She's basically talking about climate change. She says that the spring, the summer, the childing autumn, angry winter change their wanted liveries, and the mazed world by their increase now knows not which is which. I mean, she's talking about the start of the Anthropocene, basically, isn't she?
Absolutely. You're bang on. And that was Midsummer Night's Dream was written about 1594 to 5, and England had experienced catastrophic harvests and rains in the preceding 2 years, for the two preceding seasons, as it were, agricultural seasons. And so he's referring to a very topical event there, the fact that climate change is altering the seasons. You know, at another place in Shakespeare, Gloucester, I think it is, in Henry IV, Part II, says, the seasons have changed their manners.
Wow.
As if the year had found some months asleep and leapt over them. And that's what Titania is referring to. And again, here's an excellent example of the fact that Shakespeare's taking that very topical reference to climate change, the Little Ice Age in the period, and he's putting it into the mouths of these two fairies in A Midsummer Night's Dream and talking about the consequences of their rowing. And that's very typical of how Shakespeare weaves these ecological signs into his plays. Sometimes... Yeah. In a tragic context, sometimes in a humorous context.
So timber was at a premium, And there's also been a transition in fuel use, hasn't there, from an energy source from one to another. And this is the first, well, maybe not the first time, but we've seen coal start being used. But this is not coal that's been mined from deep underground as we think about it now, is it?
No, it isn't. The coal that was used back then mainly was what's called sea coal. It was called sea coal. What that really means is it was surface coal. Coal right at the surface of the earth, and it was especially plentiful in the northeast of England, and so it was dug up there fairly easily, actually, put into boats and carried down the eastern coast of England and up the Thames to London mainly, but also again to supply markets in the southeast. And coal was at that time a cheaper energy source than wood fuel, whose prices were rising. And so there was gradually a transition from wood fuel to coal fuel. At the beginning of the 16th century, coal supplied about 10% of England's energy supply. By the mid-17th century, it was 50%.
So despite being hundreds of years old and about a different time, well, there's still a message from Shakespeare that we can take to our modern problems, isn't there?
Yes, there is. Pay attention to the natural world and how we use it and how we interact with not only other human beings, but other animals and with the non-animal, as it were, natural world, and how important that integration is. Shakespeare is superb about that, and that makes him absolutely contemporary for us as a message that we really need to learn to get ourselves out of the looming calamities of the Anthropocene. That, to me, is it. Shakespeare shows us how to live a better way.
That was Rowan talking with Randall Martin of the University of New Brunswick in Canada. Now, next up, we're chatting with Adrian Tchaikovsky. He's a science fiction author known for his works exploring topics such as alien awareness. His latest book, Children of Memory, continues his Children of Time series with the story of a fragile human colony on a far-flung outpost and some corvids, which Yay. May or may not be sentient. We love that kind of thing. Yeah. So here's our books editor, Alison Flood. She chatted with him about spiders, crows, and inspiration from zoology.
Hi, Adrian. I really enjoyed Children of Memory, so thank you for that. I wanted to start by talking about your choice of species that you explored this time. So in Children of Time, it was a world where spiders had evolved. In Children of Ruin, you had a flourishing octopus civilization. And now in Children of Memory, you're looking at what might happen if corvids evolve. Was that always going to be the obvious next choice for you, or were crows always the route to take?
I mean, in a weird kind of way, I feel I've almost gone mainstream with crows, because they're with the spiders and the octopus, they tend to be creatures that a lot of people really don't like, whereas crows have a fairly good press to start with. But really, for this series in particular, my targets tend to be creatures with an unusual amount of intelligence in the natural state. So effectively good candidates for becoming a kind of a sapient species if they were given, you know, a clear evolutionary run at it. And corvids, so, you know, crows, ravens, magpies, birds like that, are very, very clearly one of those candidates. They have an extraordinary intelligence. Yeah, they demonstrate they can craft and use tools, they can understand multi-stage problems without even physically experimenting with them. They can do, I mean, frankly, they can do a lot of things cognitively better than I feel I can. And so it doesn't feel that they would need much of a push. They would just kind of need the right conditions to flourish and sort of become that sort of dominant technological species in the way we would recognize.
I mean, were there any other options that you considered before you were like, no, definitely corvids?
Oh, well, there are plenty. And I mean, I would like to expand the series at some point in the future when sort of the ideas come to me. And at that point, I will probably choose a more left field species. One of the things that we are discovering, there's been quite a flourishing of animal behavior studies in the last decade or so. And it seems to be the case that wherever you look, you actually find out that everything is smarter and more adaptable and just more intelligent in a way that we can appreciate as a human than was previously believed. So there are an enormous number of potential candidates. I mean, I a little voice in the back of my head suggests I'll probably do something else, invertebrate, because that does tend to be my first love in the animal kingdom. But who knows?
One of the things I really loved about Children of Memory is how you explore the question of sentience and whether or not your corvids, who live in a complex society and perform all sorts of feats of language and technology, are sentient. I mean, it's a big question to tackle. Did you have fun with it, or was it at times quite a head scratcher to know where you were going with it?
I had a lot of fun with it. I had a lot of fun with it in particular because of the two corvid characters in the book, Gothy and Gethly, are just enormous fun to write. They're basically a double act, a comedy double act. And at the same time, they epitomize the sort of philosophical puzzle which is at the heart of the book, which is what is a person? What is consciousness? What is intellect? Just because something is going through all the motions doesn't mean that it is intelligent. In fact, Gothy and Gethly are quite adamant that they're not, even though they can argue the point quite cogently. And obviously, also, as fans of the series will know, we have characters like Everana Kern, who is a human who has been uploaded into a variety of different sort of artificial formats, including a nest full of ants, and still kind of believes she is human up until the point when she has to think of something that happened to her and the memories just aren't there. And then there are, anyone who's read the second book, Children of Room, will know that we add some quite unusual characters and species in that. And we get quite a lot from that kind of alien point of view of something that really isn't a kind of a singular intelligent entity, except that because of its very complicated interactions, it kind of becomes one in aggregate. And the whole book is kind of exploring these different almost impersonations of sapience and sort of inviting the characters in the book and I guess the reader to think, well, what do or don't we consider to be actually intelligent in all of this sort of variety?
Yeah. I love the way the corvids throw out these literary quotes, which are entirely apt for a situation, but they're like totally forgotten by the people who are hearing them. Like at one point where they say to strive, to seek, to find and not to yield, they say as they're kind of striving and seeking and finding, but people are like, what are you talking about? That makes sense. But and that definitely felt like you were having fun with it, with the kind of the idea that the ability to parrot information doesn't necessarily correlate with understanding or with sentience.
Yes, parroting is the key phrase. The book is dedicated to a parrot. In fact, the dedication is to a parrot called Alex, which was one of the highlights of my university course, was learning about Alex the parrot, who was a parrot that had been taught under laboratory conditions to talk, but not in the sense of just repeating things, but effectively understanding syntax and grammar and actually creating new words even for concepts that the parrot sort of came up with, and was a fascinating sort of insight into the fact that actually, it was a bit of a forerunner of the studies I was mentioning, the idea that actually animals are a lot more complex and they're capable of doing a lot of things that you wouldn't necessarily think they'd need to in their natural habitat even.
Can you talk a bit about your concept for sort of how the corvids work, the necessity for them to pair bond to deal with different challenges?
Yes, so the setup that the corvids find themselves in, they are part of a really quite dismally failed terraforming attempt on a quite a hostile world. And they're kind of released into the wild, and it is assumed that they are going to die, like basically almost everything else has.
They're super annoying as well, aren't they? They're annoying, all of the humans.
Yes, like, I suppose released is not the right word. They're driven into the wild because, as curious birds will often do, they're not exactly the most considerate neighbors, and they pull things apart and make a lot of noise and do their business everywhere and so forth. So they're driven into the wild, and it's assumed they will die, and then they come back. And what it is discovered is effectively they have become a very different species through neurodiversity. Half of them are very, very novelty fixated. They can immediately see what has changed in the environment and are very prompted to examine it. The other half are analytical. They don't have that kind of environmental awareness, but they have a kind of on-running recollection of what has happened and are able to look at the information presented by the first half and then make decisions. So they function as two halves of a brain. And also, to be honest, I'm being a little coy and playing games, because what we also have, of course, are we have two ravens who are thought and memory,
who are
I do, in the same way as I've dipped into Shakespeare and I've dipped into biblical references in the previous books. In this one, I have a fair amount of Norse myth not, I suspect, in any terribly deep and meaningful way, but just because it's a nice theme and there's a lot of material there to play with that people will recognise the names and get the references of.
That was Alison Flood talking with Adrian Tchaikovsky about his new book, Children of Memory. And I hope someone gets me that for Christmas because it sounds great.
That's all for this week. Thanks to our guests Matt Sparks, James Deneen, Maddie Cuff and Alison Flood. And thanks to all of you for listening.
Do help support our journalism by subscribing so you don't miss out. Do buy the special holiday edition of the magazine. It's an awesome double issue. And that special print-only deal is at newscientist.com/print sale. And also tell everyone about our show. And we'll see you next week for a special end-of-year review. Bye for now.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
This podcast is produced by OG Podcasts. Find out more at ogpodcasts.co.uk.